from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I want to express my outrage at the despicable attack today against the French magazine Charlie Hebdo. It was a horrendous, unjustifiable, and cold-blooded crime.
That was the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon in a statement Wednesday condemning the attack by gunmen in Paris at the offices of a satirical magazine earlier in the day.
I extend my deepest condolences to the families and my best wishes to all those injured. We stand with the government and people of France. I trust that the French authorities will do all in their power to bring the perpetrators to justice quickly.
The Secretary General cautioned against allowing the attack to cause social divisions.
This horrific attack is meant to divide. We must not fall into that trap. This is a moment for solidarity around the world. We must stand strong for freedom of expression and tolerance and stand against the forces of division and hate. It was also a direct assault on a cornerstone of democracy, on the media and freedom of expression.
Not everyone is convinced that the attack will have a negative impact on the press. Journalist Barry M. Lando spent 25 years as an award-winning investigative producer with 60 Minutes and is now based in Paris. He spoke with RT Wednesday.
I don't think it would diminish freedom of speech. I'm not quite sure why it would, because I think that perhaps the question of publishing pictures of Mohammed, things like that, but otherwise I don't see it having an impact there. But I think what's also very important here is the impact that this could have on the whole question of immigrants in Europe, on Islam in Europe. The tensions have been mounting. There have been demonstrations in Germany this last week, stronger than before, stronger than ever before. And this attack is going to tie into that. It's going to tie into a very strong reaction, increased reaction to immigrants and to Islam across Europe.
China continues to develop closer ties with Latin America as a high-level meeting between China and CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean Nations, opens Thursday in Beijing. As we reported earlier this week, the Chinese capital will host a ministerial meeting between officials from China and CELAC Thursday and Friday. The first China-CELAC forum will map overall guidelines for cooperation. China's President Xi Jinping, Costa Rica's President Luis Guillermo Solis, Ecuador's President Rafael Correa Delgado, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro Moros, and the Bahamas Prime Minister Perry Christie will be in attendance. The outcome of the senior-level dialogue will be announced at a press conference by Chinese and Costa Rican foreign ministers Friday. Costa Rica holds the presidency of the group for 2015. CELAC, a regional bloc for Latin America and the Caribbean, consists of 33 sovereign countries in the Americas. Founded in 2011, it represents roughly 600 million people. CCTV's Yun Chun Zi has more.
China and Latin America have enjoyed a complementary economic relationship as their trade value has surged in the past decade. 10 years ago, the trade volume between the two was only a little bit more than $50 billion. That figure has soared since and stood at more than $260 billion in 2013. China now is Latin America's second biggest trade partner, while Latin America is China's seventh largest. Natural resources are China's traditional investment ground in Latin America, while increasing energy cooperation, such aspects as clean energy development, have great potential to become projects of the future. The president of the Cuba Chamber of Commerce cited President Xi Jinping's trip to Latin America last July in saying that the relationship is of mutual benefit.
The visit of the president in general, we see it as Cubans with lots of satisfaction. because this meeting shows the willingness of Latin America and China to work together. It's a complementary relationship, a relationship of mutual benefit, a diverse relationship.
Last July, the leaders of the BRICS countries proposed the creation of a new development bank. The bank would be headquartered in Shanghai and is intended to boost infrastructure and sustainable development projects in China, Brazil, Russia, India, and South Africa. The US dollar is the major foreign reserve currency for most Latin American countries. But after the financial crisis of 2009, the countries are seeking a more diversified basket of foreign reserves. Analysts from the Inter-American Development Bank say that the Latin American countries are looking forward to more renminbi settlements. That's because RMB settlements could quicken the pace for yuan's internationalization and help hedge forex risk for Latin American traders. Yang Chengxi, CCTV.
Li Yang is vice chair of the China Association of International Trade. He spoke with CCTV's Lin Danying Wednesday.
I think we need to look at the three areas. I think this forum is going to push forward the relationship. One is the political relationship. I think this platform is going to provide an opportunity for the for China and South American and Caribbean states. An opportunity to really discuss, the collective positions in terms of reshaping the global governance. And secondly, is about the deepening of the economic cooperation, which is I think is going to be based on the past initiatives. And this forum is the. I would call it a culmination mm-hmm. of all the past initiatives, and there will be a lot of projects, I think, that will be put together in a comprehensive context. And the third area, I think, will be the development and the deepening of the people-to-people exchange.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, and talking about the fields of cooperation, China is now Latin America's second largest trading partner and also the third biggest source of investment. Then in what specific areas are the two sides going to cooperate in?
I would like to recall Xi Jinping's initiative when he visited Brazil. To attend the China's Latin America and Caribbean State Summit. At that time, Xi Jinping proposed a framework of 1+3+6. Mm-hmm. I think basically the area of cooperation will be generally in line with the proposal. For example, one means one. Five-year plan mm-hmm. for China and the Latin American countries for the cooperation. And the three means that, the key three engines that will drive the economic cooperation between China and Latin American and Caribbean states, which include trade, investment, and finance. According to that, I think probably in 10 years' time, we can expect the trade volume to reach 500 billion U.S. dollars, and China's investment in the area will total something like 250 mm-hmm. billion U.S. dollars. And of course, there are other cooperation initiatives like in currency. Area, for example, currency swap, the settlement in local currency, mm-hmm. and more specifically, the areas of cooperation, that is reflected in the six areas actually, which include energy resources, infrastructure, agriculture, manufacturing, science and technology, mm-hmm. and telecommunications. Those are the priorities, mm-hmm. but. I think, areas may not be limited to those, but, those are the priorities of cooperation in the future.
We will be covering the CELAC conference and will report back later this week. As China and the other BRICS countries continue to develop closer economic and financial ties, things are not going so well for the EU, which appears to be moving backwards on several fronts. In Greece, upcoming elections are widely believed to hold a real possibility that Syriza, the coalition of the radical left, could gain power and repudiate the austerity regime imposed by the country's troika of creditors, the EU, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. The coalition, which is leading in the polls, has at the center of its current program a European debt conference where the states of the Eurozone would convene a summit that would forgive a large portion of Greece's debt, accompanied by a European New Deal of public investment to spur consumption and revitalize the Eurozone's economy. We'll have more on that later in this newscast. Meanwhile, Iceland may be moving away from its commitment to join the EU. RT's Andrew Farmer has more.
Iceland is reportedly considering withdrawing its application to join the European Union that was made back in 2009. It will be the second time since an anti-EU party came to power in Reykjavik 2 years ago that the government has considered the move. Well, to discuss this more, we're joined now by Erika Bergman, a professor of political science at the Centre of European Studies at the Bifrost University in Iceland. Thanks very much for coming on to the programme. Can you tell us, why is Iceland considering changing its mind on this?
Well, Iceland has for a decade now almost been completely split on the issue whether to join the European Union or not. And after the massive financial crisis in the autumn of 2008, the then left-wing government that came into power saw it as one of the main vehicles for reform and recovery to re-establish links with the international community and apply for EU membership. But the government wasn't able to finish the negotiations before the coming election in 2013, where the opposition was voted in, the right of central government which we have now, and they have completely the opposite policy of not joining the European Union.
Why is that?
And they
Well,
Iceland is completely split on the issue whether our interests are better protected within the European Union or outside of it. And there are several issues at play. One of the issues driving Iceland into the EU is to try to underpin our falling currency, which has been locked behind capital controls since the crash. And many see EU membership being of the greatest economic benefits in order to sort of secure monetary policy. On the other hand, the opposition is mostly because of ideas of independence. This is a government that really treasures the country's independence and really wants Iceland to remain on its own and outside of major economic blocs like the European Union. But the difficulty is that Iceland is already closely linked with the European Union, even a shadow member of the EU already through an agreement called the European Economic Area Agreement.
The last time that the government sort of suggested it was going to move away from joining the EU completely, there were street protests, weren't there? There were a lot of demonstrations. Is the feeling running that high that you'd expect to see a similar response this time?
It might well be. This, as I said earlier, the nation is split in half on the issue. And very many people feel that the process should be completed. Iceland had applied for EU membership, and many people feel that they had been promised the chance to vote on the issue finally and resolve it in a referendum. And many feel that if the government revokes the application without consulting the nation in a referendum, that is a massive betrayal on the half of the government, and a lot of the protests was because of this feeling of betrayal rather than the wish of joining the European Union.
Do you feel it's likely that a referendum will happen then? Why don't they offer a referendum on this?
This government has said that they will not put it to a referendum. Probably they are afraid of the wrong results for their politics. So I would predict that this stalemate, which is in Iceland, will continue.
Well, welcome everybody. Feliz año nuevo. It is a pleasure to welcome once again President Peña Nieto as well as his delegation. It's appropriate that our first meeting of the year is with one of our closest allies, neighbors, and friends.
That was U.S. President Barack Obama Tuesday as he met with the President of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, and the members of his cabinet at the White House. President Peña Nieto has faced increasingly vocal protests across Mexico since the disappearance and presumed murder of 43 student teachers in Iguala this past September. Telesur's Clayton Kahn filed this report from Mexico City.
While the agenda for Obama and Peña Nieto at the White House was heavy on trade and immigration, neither one could avoid the issue of insecurity and crime that plagues Mexico.
Obviously, you know, we've been following here in the United States some of the tragic events surrounding the students whose lives were lost. President Peña Nieto was able to describe to me the reform programs that he's initiated around these issues. Our commitment is to be a friend and supporter of Mexico in its efforts to eliminate the scourge of violence and the drug cartels that are responsible for so much tragedy inside of Mexico, and we want to be a good partner in that process.
Agradezco al presidente Obama la disposición que ha mostrado y que nos ha confirmado para seguir trabajando en materia de seguridad ante el claro reto que tiene México de combatir con mayor eficacia y contundencia al crimen organizado.
And I thank you, President Obama, for your willingness to continue working with Mexico in terms of security, especially in this clear challenge Mexico has to continue fighting organized crime.
En este tema de la seguridad ha habido colaboración, ha habido intercambio de información y apoyo logístico para hacer nuestra labor en materia de seguridad. Sin embargo, ha habido aquí un claro ofrecimiento para seguir apoyando y respaldando estas acciones que nos permitan ser mucho más contundentes y eficaces en el combate a la inseguridad y sobre todo en el combate a el crimen organizado.
And here we've been discussing topics that have to do with security, of course, and the collaboration, the exchange of information, and the logistic support that we're already getting. And I want to thank you, President Obama, for offering to continue this very efficient actions for us to fight insecurity and especially organized crime.
Although President Obama asked that Mexican authorities take the lead on the country's security, here in Mexico, members of the leading opposition party expressed distrust owing to the United States' historic participation in the so-called drug war.
To offer support to our country on the matter of security is nothing more than continuing to invade in a meddling kind of way through plans such as the Merida Initiative.
Implemented in 2007, the Merida Initiative is a security cooperation agreement between both countries to combat organized crime. However, rights organizations say the effects of this continued strategy have been devastating for Mexico.
There's a grave crisis in human rights marked by 23,000 disappearances, and what Ayotzinapa and these numbers unmask is a crisis in violence, violence that we live every day, and an inadequate security strategy.
Human rights experts say that without including a comprehensive human rights strategy into security, violence will only continue to rise, as well as the country's widespread social discontent. Clayton Kahn, Telesur, Mexico City.
But if Mexico's president thought he was taking a break from protests by leaving his country, he was quickly disabused of that notion as demonstrations erupted across 20 cities in the United States Tuesday. People took to the streets in Washington, as well as in front of Mexican consulates in Los Angeles, Houston, New York, Seattle, St. Louis, Salt Lake City, and Dallas, among other cities, to protest the president's visit to the White House. The demonstrators called on the Obama administration to instead cut all funding to Mexico using the Leahy Amendment, which prohibits military aid to countries that violate human rights. The U.S. has reportedly given some $2.5 billion to Mexico since 2008 through the Merida Initiative. Meanwhile, the Mexican government announced that it has moved the wife of the Iguala mayor to a federal jail, where she faces charges of murder and racketeering. Press TV's Alistair Baverstock was in Mexico City and filed this report.
The wife of the Iguala mayor, who was accused of orchestrating the abduction and murder of 43 Mexican students last year, has been transferred to a federal jail. Maria de los Angeles Pineda, known as Mexico's First Lady of Murder, who founded the Guerreros Unidos criminal cartel, faces charges of organized crime and multiple homicides. The arrest of Mexico's imperial couple in a Mexico City slum was a major breakthrough in a case that once threatened to bring down Mexico's government.
The government mismanagement is scandal, and they are desperately looking for someone to blame. It's for this reason that we can certainly expect a persecution of both Pineda and her husband.
Pineda's family have a long history of criminal involvement. Both her parents are behind bars for cooperation with the mafia, while three other siblings were murdered in incidents of gangland violence. Despite her detention, many Mexicans still believe that the government should answer for the tragic loss of the 43 students.
It's a huge tragedy. The authorities have managed the situation badly, and now they are looking for an easy way out. I don't think the sole prosecution of these two criminals would satisfy the public.
With the capture and prosecution of Mexico's First Lady of Murder, the Mexican authorities will hope to put the case of the 43 missing students to bed. Whether it will ease any of the pressure on Mexico's government will depend on the extent to which the imperial couple is scapegoated for the establishment's failings. Alistair Bavistock, Press TV, Mexico City.
In Greece, upcoming elections hold a real possibility that the leftist coalition Syriza could gain power and, some observers fear, repudiate the austerity regime imposed by the country's creditors, the EU, the IMF, and the European Central Bank. But Walter Smolarek of the U.S.-based Party for Socialism and Liberation disagrees. He spoke with Liberation Radio's Sean Garcia Sunday.
The Greek economy has been devastated during the ongoing economic crisis. So in 2009, there's a major collapse of the Greek economy, partially because the government was in an incredible amount of debt. And as a result, the Troika was set up, which consists of the European Union, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. And in return for bailing out the Greek banks and other major corporations, the Greek government agreed to what's referred to as the memorandum, which is basically an agreement to impose devastating austerity measures on poor and working people in Greece. And so that includes things like slashing pensions, raising the retirement age, lowering the minimum wage, deregulating industry, privatizing public companies. So it's basically just a general offensive against the working class in Greece. So there have been two bailouts and two memorandums, and the second memorandum is supposed to be coming to an end. The bailout money is distributed in a series of installments, and the final installment has yet to be paid because the Greek government was still in the middle of negotiations with the Troika about how to extend the bailout program or to have some sort of supplementary monitoring program. So that's all sort of hanging over the Greek government's head. And now they have to head into early elections on January 25th. And that's because the Parliament of Greece failed to elect a replacement for the current president, who's retiring. The president is largely a ceremonial role in Greece, but the constitution mandates that he be elected with 180 votes, so out of 300 in the parliament. So while the government had a majority in parliament, they did not have enough to elect a new president. Mm.
So Syriza is widely expected to win these elections. Can you say more about who they are?
Yeah, so Syriza is the coalition of the radical left. Before the 2012 parliamentary elections, they were a relatively small party. It was actually composed of several different parties. One of the major components was what we call like a Euro-communist split from the Communist Party of Greece, which at the time was much larger. there are also several other leftist parties involved in that, a lot from like the Trotskyist or Maoist traditions. And so after seemingly coming out of nowhere to get second place in 2012, they've begun to develop a more unitary structure. And part of this process, under the leadership of Alexis Tsipras, the name of the party leader, the Syriza has been moving, you know, very rapidly to the right in recent months and years. So while they originally ran on the platform of, you know, they would say, like, we're going to tear up the memorandum, you know, cancel all the austerity measures. And they also campaigned for what they called, like, a government of the left, which, you know, all the parties to the left of the traditional social democratic party, which is called CASOC in Greece. Now the core of their platform is what they call a European Med Conference, which is going to be theoretically accompanied by a European New Deal. So basically the idea is that the imperialist states that compose the Eurozone would get together and agree to forgive a large amount of Greece's debt. And then at the same time, they would invest hundreds of billions of dollars into, you know, basically like what the New Deal was in the United States, massive infrastructure programs, things to stimulate demand and, you know, just general investment in the economy. So, one, this is, I mean, it's an extremely unlikely scenario given the resistance that would likely come from Germany and other powerful imperialist states in the Eurozone. And also it's fundamentally a social democratic program, right? Mm-hmm. The emphasis that all the Syriza leaders have been giving in the run-up to the election is that, one, we won't make any unilateral moves. Right, all of this is going to be negotiated with the Troika, with the European Union. And two, that this is good for both capitalists and workers. That, you know, public investment would kickstart growth in the economy, and that would allow austerity measures to be lifted and also for capitalist firms to return to profitability. So they really lost whatever revolutionary politics that they have had.
Mm. And are there any other strong leftist parties in Greece, and how does their strategy intersect with Syriza?
Well, the other large leftist party is the Communist Party of Greece. So they have, you know, a very large base in the working class that goes back decades and decades. And their strategy is what they call constructing a people's alliance. And a people's alliance is basically, you know, a block in society of the oppressed classes and the middle elements to, you know, small business people, farmers, you know, people who may not be traditionally thought of as, like, the most oppressed layers of the proletariat, but who still have an interest in fighting against monopoly capital. So they hope to, in, you know, outside of parliament, to build this people's alliance as the revolutionary force in society. And they also intervene in the elections, calling for the socialization of all major industry, and, you know, basically the core of their program is the socialist transformation of society. However, they're not pulling anywhere near what Syriza is, and they've unfortunately been unable to achieve a breakthrough in either the mass movement or the electoral arena. So they've been, you know, very sharply criticizing Syriza's strategy, but it remains to be seen how effectively they'll be able to win over large numbers of oppressed people in Greece and organize for revolution.
So if Syriza wins later this month, what are some other likely outcomes in addition to what you spoke about earlier?
Well, I think that the established powers in the European Union and the Eurozone will be extremely concerned about it, even though, you know, Syriza is really backed off from its most radical policies. You know, while both say that they're totally committed to keeping Greece in the single currency area, you know, the group of, I believe, 17 countries that use the euro currency, Syriza is more of an unknown factor. And so, like, for example, when the parliament failed to elect a president, the Greek stock market, like, totally crashed. The bond market crashed as well. Although that may calm down if Syriza makes it clear that they're willing to make significant compromises. With the Troika.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.